Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today, we're listening to Four Funnel Cruises of Australia, an address by Mr. John Bastock, tracing the career of the four funnel cruisers of the RAN.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your complimentary remarks, many of which I think are entirely undeserved. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. When the 1st Australian Fleet Unit arrived in Sydney on the 4th of October 1913, I had a pretty good view of the events because I was taken down as a small boy to the site of the present Opera House, Bennelong Point, near Bennelong Point and quite close to Man O' War's Ferry. And as it appeared that there must have been at least half the population of Sydney present, I prevailed upon my father to sit me on his shoulder, which he did, and so I had a very fine view of the entry of our fleet. Everyone, of course, was impressed with the great battlecruiser Australia, which was the flagship of the squadron. But as a young boy, I must confess, like all other youngsters, that I was most impressed with the sleek light cruisers which lay alongside the Australia, not alongside the Australia, but between the Australia and Garden Island at numbers 2 and 3 buoy, which we used to call them then. Number 2 was halfway between Bennelong Point and Mrs. Macquarie's chair, and number 3 was right off Mrs. Macquarie's chair. And to see these four funnelers belting forth their smoke, I was very impressed. Little did I think at the time, as a lad, that one day, some years later, I would be serving in these two ships, and not only in these two, but also in their young sister, which at that point of time was just barely taking shape on the stocks of Cockatoo Island, and she was to be named Brisbane, and she wasn't due in the water for another 2 years after that. And so I'd like to tell you something tonight about these four funnel cruisers. Now these three, I'll treat them alphabetically if I can think of them each time, I'll probably forget ago, Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney were the first cruisers built for the RAN. They were built to the design of the Chatham Group of the British Town Class light cruisers, which were built before World War I as a counter to the very large number of German cruisers coming into service. They were very nice little ships, very handsome little ships, I thought, with their raking masts and funnels, their cutaway bow and overhanging stern, and they look fine, particularly when they are belching plenty of smoke. I don't know what the environmentalists would think about that, but we thought they looked all right at that stage. In the Chatham Group, to which this little class belonged, the forecastle of the ship was taken right out nearly to the mainmast, and on this level 5 of the 8 6-inch guns were carried. In earlier classes of British ships, one of the weaknesses in design was that the forecastle was broken about this point near the bridge and run out. And at that time, the principle of putting all the guns on the centre line of the ship to fire on each side hadn't been fully developed, and much of the main armament had to be carried on the sides of the ship. And you can imagine, at this level, guns up here on the side of the ship would be fairly low in command, and not only that, they would be washed out, and any sort of a sea running from the bears right down to the beam. And not only was this uncomfortable for the gun's crews, because they were practically had to hang on for life when each greenback washed over the ship, but there was a more serious problem as well. The armament of these ships at this time was made up of separate ammunition. That is, the 6-inch shell was separate to the charge. The shell was put into the gun first, followed by a cordite charge. On each end of the cordite charge was a little powder bag, a bag of gunpowder. And you all know how that is, keep your powder dry. Well, with greenbacks washing over the ship, it was pretty hard to keep your powder dry, and the result would be a misfire, because you can't light or you can't ignite wet powder. And so the guns were useless. But in the Chatham group, as we say, the structural deck was extended nearly aft to the mainmast. And at this height, 5 of the 8 6-inch guns were carried. And so there was no problem with seas washing over the ship. If the seas were so rough that those guns couldn't be worked, well, it was time to go home and come to fight another day. Because it was the same belt that the other fellow was thinking the same thing. Now, for a bit of an in-depth look at this Chatham group of ships. There were 5,400 tons displacement. That is about 800 tons heavier than our present guided missile destroyer, which for the sake of people not conversant with Navy jargon, we call that those the DDGs at the present day. Their overall length was 457 feet, and they were about 20 feet longer than the DDGs. That doesn't seem very much. 20 feet in this overall length is not much. But these ships did look much bigger than our present DDGs, which are a very handsome ship, but more like they are, in fact, a big destroyer. But these little Chatham-class cruisers looked every inch a fighting ship and a cruiser. They were well armed for their size too. And these 6-inch 50 caliber guns, they fired a shell weighing 100 pounds. And that was the heaviest hand-loaded shell in the British Naval Services at the time. As a secondary armament, they carried a 4 3-pounder gun, seen on the plan in this position and on the elevation here. As a secondary armament, I would suspect that they were only second-hand guns, and I also believe that they would have been useless against anything that they were fired against. But they had a couple of good uses. That was for frightening the heck out of natives in the islands if they became a little bit unruly. And also, of course, their primary purpose in these ships was for saluting purposes. In those days, everything was very unsophisticated, and for timing, when they saluted, to bring a nice timing to the salute, and some of the older ships will remember this here, the gunner's mate used to stand on a platform adjacent to them. And when the order was given to let fire for the royal salute or what have you, he would say, "Fire one. If I wasn't a gunner, I wouldn't be here. Fire two. If I wasn't a gunner, I wouldn't be here. Fire three." And so forth. And that sounded very good. It was very nicely spaced. And that's the way they got over the spacing of their royal salute and all that type of thing. It's interesting to note that when these ships were first commissioned and arrived in Sydney Harbour, no provision was made for fighting aircraft or for attacking submarines. My Lords of the Admiralty at that period evidently thought that the aircraft was just a toy, and the submarine as well. But they were, of course, a few years later to learn the lesson in the hard way, and the ships eventually were armed with a 3-pounder with a 12-pounder 3-inch gun in this position as an attacker or defender rather against aircraft. And not only that, this little gun was also the ship's star shell gun. That is, it illuminated the target with star shells. It was found very early in World War I that as soon as you switch your searchlights on, particularly if you did them at both ends of the ship, you were a sitting duck. So the lesson was quickly learnt that you don't switch your lights on. If the lookout picked up a suspected enemy, you fired star shell to illuminate it. And that was very good because the target was illuminated with a sickly yellow pyrotechnic display, which was very efficient. But the little gun made a dreadful noise, and if you got anywhere near the thing, you're bound to have bad eardrums after the star shell display was all over. They were powered by turbines, not geared turbines, but direct drive Parsons turbines, and their horsepower was 25,000. Their maximum speed, or design speed rather, was 25.5 knots. But by stoking them up a little with a little blood, sweat and tears, another knot could be extracted from them in favorable conditions. They were four screwed vessels. They had four screws. Their later sister Adelaide only had two. That's why I don't include her in tonight's discourse. Another point of the armament was the torpedo armament. They had two 21-inch submerged torpedo tubes. And they were in this position here, looking on the elevation. They were practically underneath this forward-fairing gun. And the starboard tube was a little further forward than the port tube, because the beam of the ship was fairly narrow, 50 feet, and you couldn't put two tubes end to end, so they were staggered, the starboard tube being the foremost of the two. It had been claimed up to about this period that submerged torpedo tubes were a great idea because the enemy couldn't see you firing at him. Well, now that was true, but this was not always an advantage, because at some stage, and this was found to be vital during, particularly during World War II, as well as World War I, that you wanted the enemy to see your firing torpedoes at him. Because as soon as you let loose with torpedoes, he had to take some evasive action. The quickest way to get rid of torpedoes, if you know they're coming at you, is to turn towards them and cone them and get out of the way as quickly as possible. So if you wanted to shorten the range, let him see you fire some torpedoes at him and he turned towards you and shortened the range, and that was good. Or he did the other thing and turned away. But the anxiety period then was much longer if he did that. So the submerged tube wasn't always an advantage. Another great disadvantage was that you imagine the ship slipping through the water at about 20 knots and firing a torpedo measuring about 25 feet in length. Before it got halfway through, the torpedo would snap off like a carrot. And this was a great disadvantage too. So this entailed the installation of a very heavy thing called a bar. And this heavy phosphor bond bar had to be run out before the torpedo, and it protected the torpedo until it got clear of the tube. And that was the way that was overcome. But the underwater torpedo installation was a pretty messy business. These ships carried, by the way, an outfit of about 8 or 9 torpedoes at the mate. And it was a very strenuous task, loading these things in, and it entailed a great number of interlocks on the tube for safety purposes, because there had to be a front door to keep the water out while you loaded your torpedo. And there was a side door on the torpedo tube and a rear door. You had to close the front door, you had to open the rear and side doors, and then close them up again before the front door was open. And before you fired the torpedo, you had to know that the bar was run out, and all this entailed a very expensive and heavy installation. And in any case, by the time you've fired about half a dozen torpedoes, as well as being exhausted, you would be up to your knees in salt water, which had to be pumped out of that. So it was a bit of a messy business all around. They say that some people are born famous, some acquire fame, and some have fame thrust upon them. On one occasion, on one of these ships, I think it was the Sydney, I happened to be the leading torpedo operator, as they call it, LDA, as they used to call it, on one of the torpedo tubes, and we were having a practice run in Jervis Bay. And we were in local control, which meant I had to fire the starboard torpedo tube by pulling the lever back, and this was done. This was a more or less a routine exercise. And later on when I came up on deck, I was congratulated, and I had my name in the paper next day, because I was supposed to be the only man in the RAM that had killed a shark with a torpedo. Whether this should go down in the Guinness Book of Records, I don't know. But this actually happened. The bar was run out, and as sharks are very nosy things, they come up to have a sniff of this Postlebond bar, and just as this big shark came up, out slipped the pinfish, and there was shark blood and bits of shark skin everywhere. I didn't see it, but this is what I was told. I don't know whether there's really much else we can talk about the diagram. In the first, when these ships were first built, they were, had just pole masts, two long pole masts. There was no director firing in those days. Just to tell you what director firing is, there's a director on the top of the mast, and it has everything that a gun has, practically, but no barrel. It doesn't fire. It just trains round and electrically transmits to all the guns on that side, which follow the pointer of the director and they mow them on the target. And that's what you call director firing. And when everything's ready, the director gun layer in the director tower presses the trigger and fires the guns, and that's all there is. But this was not known, and or not developed, rather, at the beginning of World War I. And they only had pole masts and a very light control top, and the masts had to be high because the wireless telegraphy installations in those days were very weak, and you had to have a very high mast for transmission. Also with the WT, there was no voice as there is now, it was all Morse code, of course. With the searchlights, they were built with very small searchlights in this position. Later on, 36 inch diameter searchlights were installed, as you see in this diagram. As built too, they had a conning tower in this position, a very heavily armoured cylindrical structure called a conning tower. And this is where the ship was conned from in action. So when the director tower installation was put in, the conning tower became redundant, and later on it was taken out after the war. But an interesting point is that over the conning tower, both the Melbourne and the Sydney, during their service in the North Sea, had an aeroplane platform erected. And from on there, they used to carry their little Sopwith Camel fighter plane. And this plane could take off with a run of only 9 feet, which is amazing to me. I suppose for people who understand aircraft, it wouldn't be very much. But the ship steamed into the wind, and the little plane was airborne and only a run of 9 feet. Of course, they couldn't land on again. They had to either make a landfall or a ditch and hope to be picked up by the nearest ship. When they were picked up by their parent ship, they were hoisted in by what we call the main derrick in this position, and they have stayed in this position, which we call the booms on these ships. Another innovation with the Chatham group was that they had a side armour belt. You can see it running along here, in this position here. After that time, the light cruisers in the British Naval Services only had a protected deck. That is, a horizontal deck which went right over the vitals of the ship, right over the magazine and engine room, and it was about 2 inches thick. Much like putting a lid on a shoe box. and that could have worked. These ships held, but they also had side armour, and that was 3 inches thick in this position over the vital part, and it tapered off to 1 inch at each end. Then it extended a little bit below the waterline to give some protection against light draft running torpedoes. They had no stabilisers, of course, in those days, so the usual type of bilge keel was fitted to the ship each side to stop them from rolling. They were very seaworthy little ships. They had an endurance of about 4,000 miles. That means that if we went around Australia, we'd fill up in Sydney, we'd top up our bunkers or refill in Darwin or Thursday Island. That would be enough to carry us around to Fremantle or Albany. When we filled up again and we came back into Sydney with very light bunkers. Carolyn Ship, and I know that there are some here, one at least in the audience who has coal ship, probably on these ships, was a pretty hard job. Everyone got into it except the wireless telegraphy operators. And they got out of the job on the chief of the Dragoon net patch for Morse code. I never believed this. That was the thing. Even the captain joined in, but not the WP fellows. No, they sat away in their little cabin and they said, no, we know what our touch room, but we can't send Morse code properly. The boat complement was of the ship. I know at least one of our audience were interested in the boats, and we carried a good supply of boats. Carly floats and things and all sorts of paper inflatable rafts weren't very well developed in these days, and we relied on the old lifeboat, old-fashioned lifeboat. We had 2 30-foot cutters on each side, and they were used all the time as sea boats. We also had a larger cutter, which sometimes had a motor in it. We had a nice little motorboat. We had a 27-foot whaler and a 30-foot gig, which was the captain's boat exclusively. And if you happened to be on the captain's staff, you had a ride in the gig. I was fortunate enough to be on the captain's messenger on the Melbourne on one occasion, and I had all sorts of nice trips with the captain in the gig. Now, here's something that's always struck me as a bit queer with British warship design. And most of you who conversed with pictures of warships of this date might have scratched your heads about it too. Now, it's a universal law of the sea that the things to starboard are odd-numbered and the things to port are even-numbered. To bring us a little bit nearer home, most of you might, or some of you at least, might have let yourself go on a P&A cruise at some time. And when you had a look at the lifeboats on the starboard side, you'd see number 1, 3, 5, 7 and so forth, number 2, 2, 4, 6, 8, and that was all good. And then you want to order course to starboard, you send one short blast on the siren. At the port, 2 short blasts. Odds on the starboard, evens to port. Now why did they put 2 anchors on the starboard side and 1 on the port side in British naval design? Our anchors in these ships, the bower anchors, the bower of the ship's main anchor, weighed 4 tons, 1,800 weight. And in all British warship design, cruisers and upward, at least, not destroyers, but cruisers and upward, we carried a spare anchor in this position, which was the sheet anchor, the same weight as the bows. But in all British warship design, this was carried on the starboard side. I'd like to know, I've asked many a person about it and wondered about it for many years. I've had many answers, but none of them satisfied me. Somebody might be able to tell me later. Coming further aft, we have the breakwater here, of course, is to break the course of seas coming over the forecastle. The forecastle gun could train right forward and well above the beam on either side. The guns on the starboard side of the mark were numbered S1, 2, 3, and the P1, 2, 3 on the port, and the quarter deck gun here. The breakwater did another useful service. Apart from breaking the water, it saved you from depressing the forecastle gun sufficiently to blow a bit of the forecastle away. And the same happened with the quarterdeck gun. You had a stop here for the same purpose. The little rangefinders One was mounted on the bridge, one was mounted on the African star. In those days, of course, we had no radar, and the range finder was the only method you had of ascertaining the range of the enemy. They were an optical range finder, about 10 feet long. They had a little eyepiece at each end, which trained on the enemy at a certain angle, of course. And the range taker sat in the middle, and he looked in, and he twiddled both his hands like putting up the volume on a transistor radio. And he could see two images, one from each side. And when he got the two images there, he knew that he was on the range, and he pressed his foot, and that meant cut. And when he cut with his range, this was transmitted electrically to the transmission station down below, to the core control, the director, and all the guns. As soon as they saw the light go on, they said, that's the range of the present moment, he's right on his cut. And the little transmission station right underneath in the bounds of the ship in this area used to collate the information from the rangefinders. Both rangefinders would be on the target, and they'd take the arrows and they'd feed it through all the vital parts, particularly the guns. And the sight setter on the gun would apply that range to the gun by depressing the telescope. If it was, say, 5,000 yards, he'd wind the range to match the instruments, and in doing that, he'd depress the telescope. And the fellow that was on the gun rail, the gun, he'd have to bring the gun up to get his telescope on the target. So the gun came up automatically when he was on the target. And that's how the range was put on the gun. I don't think there's very much more. The boats were all generally hoisted by hand. There were plenty of sailors to hoist them. We had the normal complement was 390. For flagships, it went up to about 450. But one of the watches of sailors, half or a third of the sailors on duty, can easily hoist one of these boats. With the exception of the motorboat, it's pretty heavy, and you need all the ship's company, or most of them, to get the motorboat up. But sometimes we used to use the culling winches. We had a culling winch here and another culling winch here, and these would be used to help the ship's company hoist the boats. The culling winches also were used to hoist up and down the paravane, because we did have a paravane outfit, and the paravane was designed as an underwater kite. During the war, First World War, the paravane was invented for the ship to protect itself when it was going through moored minefields. The mines were moored 7 or 8 feet below the surface, and you had to cut the mine cables to get through safely. There's very little danger ever hitting right on the bows. You just accepted that. But the paravanes were in a forked V shape, carried on wire. And they were underneath the ship at about 40 degrees. And as the ship went along, you struck a mine. It was deflected aft to the jaws of the paravane. The paravane cut it off, it came to the surface, and there it could be destroyed by gunfire or small arms fire. So the paravanes were a very handy appliance in both world wars. On one occasion, the Shropshire did quite a few miles during World War II with a paravane, with a mine stuck in one of the paravanes. And this was, if you read the history, you'll see what an anxious time they had. But that was the paravane set up in these little ships. Oh, we had three boiler rooms and two engine rooms on these ships. The boiler rooms shared the funnels between them. Number one boiler room, all coal of course, used number one and half of number two funnel. Number two boiler room used half of number two and half of number three funnel. And number three boiler room used half of number three and a whole of number four funnel. And this accounted for the smoke pouring up all these funnels. We had two engine rooms, the former engine room driving the outside screws, the outer engine room driving the inside screws. For ammunition supply, we look at ships, even naval people, I think we look at ships and we admire them and we say, why didn't they put a gun here? Why didn't they put a gun there? But we've got to remember that ammunition supply is a very critical part of the design in a ship. You just can't put a gun anywhere, even though it might be desirable for attacking purposes. You must arrange for an ammunition supply which is quick and safe and does the job most efficiently. These ships had an ammunition supply at each end, a magazine at each end. The foremost magazine supplied the focal gun, P1 and S1. And the after magazine supplied S3, P3 and the quarter deck gun. And these two guns in the centre, the ammunition was taken along from either magazine along one of the passages on a luggage trolley type of thing and hoisted up by hand through a little hatch in this area here. And this was the most efficient method of supplying the guns with ammunition. The little star shell gun, or the anti-aircraft gun, the ammunition there was mainly in the after magazine, and a lot of ready-use ammunition was stowed around the gun itself in lockers. I don't think there's very much more we can see on this diagram, so perhaps now we can have a few slides and we'll talk about them with each individual ship. First of all, before we get on the diagram, is there anything, while Kevin's fixing up, is there any question someone would like?
The beam of those screws.
The beam was 50 feet, just on 50 feet. Yes.
And at what period were the pole masts converted to tripod?
During the 1917 period, and in the Brisbane 1918, during the First World War.
Yes, and you mentioned that the Adelaide was twin screws.
She was a twin.
How did the horsepower and speed compare?
They were approximately the same.
Really?
Yes, just about the same.
I saw the Adelaide do a trial for a long time.
Yes, 25,000 horsepower.
Yes.
I dare say, I'm not a naval architect, we have some here I know, they might explain it, but I think it was explained by the fact that they had a greater component of oil fuel. These little ships carried wholly coal. The Adelaide was part oil fired when she was
from the start.
And
these were converted subsequently.
No, they were never converted. They were coal right up till their time. And the Brisbane, all coal.
The builders of the Sydney and Melbourne.
The builders of the Sydney were the London and Glasgow Company at Govan on the Clyde. London and Glasgow, shipbuilding and iron company.
They built the Osterley.
Yes. Now the Melbourne was built by Cammell Laird and Company of Birkenhead and Cheshire, right opposite Liverpool. And the Brisbane, of course, was built at Cockerill Island.
Thank you. Now, have you got the ammunition up, John? Like you said, the ammunition was 100 pounds per shell. Well, that's a pretty heavy thing for one man to carry. So how was the ammunition carried? How was it carried for the gun? How did you lift it into the gun?
It was lifted by hand. Yes, and it was very heavy. It was the heaviest in the British naval service. I've got a ladder at home, which is an aluminium extension ladder, and it weighs 49 pounds, and I can hardly lift it. And there's plenty of things to grip on. But with a projectile standing on the upper deck, they were pretty heavy. People have told me and told others about my shipmates, some of them are here tonight, old shipmates, that they used to sling these things around, but I never believed that. They did have a practice loader on the deck, and you'd get into this thing for a couple of hours and load dummy shells, which weighed 100 pounds, into this loader, and it was pretty heavy work. But for anyone who tells that they threw 100 pound shells around like ping pong balls, don't believe them, because they were very heavy.
Well,
how
were you getting them up from the magazine?
They were hoisted up. They were hoisted up in a little hand lift from the magazine. In a hand lift.
And they trolley
were
along
trolley. Yes, a little trolley.
And they
went along right to the gun. In this case, they were taken along the passages and hoisted up again with a little purchase onto the upper deck, and from there was all by hand.
Now, what would happen if there's heavy sea and the boat was ploughing in and up down like that, and they're trolleying this 100-pound shells along the deck there? Wouldn't the weight sort of tend to throw them all over the place?
Well, this is what he got paid for. To keep it steady. This is what we did. We got sat on 6 a week. We got for knowing how to get over that. And I don't know how.
Excuse me, John.
With
regard to aircraft, I could be wrong, but I believe it wasn't Stockton's Camel, so the Stockton's one was not set up for a pup.
The Stockton's pup was installed in the very first installation. That's the very first plan they had, was a Stockton's pup. But I think they only remained in them for about 2 weeks. And they took them out and put Suffolk Camels in. That's Sydney and Melbourne. Brisbane, of course, had a Suffolk baby seaplane.
The other thing is, I understand that the heaviest shell is that the Royal Navy and the United States Navy maintain could be lifted by hand, albeit one boat on either side, and carry all the ships on the side, weigh about 100 tons.
By hand.
By hand?
Oh yes, two men could lift that, but this one was single-handed.
Not anything above that, of course, handled.
Yes, the 7.5, it was mostly handled by tackle, but in the final stages, two men had a device which clamped out of them, they could lift it.
I believe the last one was carrying the Hawkins.
That's right. Mm. They were a very big shell, the 7.5, because when you go up in diameter, even 1 inch, it puts a terrible lot of weight on the shell.
7.5
was very
popular
with
the
cruise
boat.
Why, it's
a bit too heavy to handle
much of
that
ease. That's right. But they were a nice ship and a nice gun, the 7.5s, but they didn't last very long. Of course, they were superseded by the 8-inch, which was, of course, I think a 260-pound shell.
Yes. So, your business is two anchors on the starboard bow and one anchor on the port bow.
Yes?
One answer that I was intending to understand was, if you built ships like that in the northern hemisphere, in the southern hemisphere, you had two anchors on the port bow and one on the starboard bow. Why is anybody's guess?
Well, some of these were built in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, but they were
I've heard that one before. I've heard also that they compensated for various types of baits. Yes, I've heard everything, but I've never said it.
One question. Were all of the four of those class of ships, the town cruisers, did they all have 8 6-inch guns?
These three had 8 6-inch guns.
I believe one of them had one less or one more.
The Adelaide had one more. Oh. But I'm not dealing with the Adelaide tonight. She's
right.
A different one.
Now
these only had 8. And all those had 8. Yes.
Just one more thing. I believe the United States Navy followed
the 2-anchor
starboard one
before the idea as well. Well, I don't know. The same question arose as to why the island an aircraft carrier was located on the starboard side.
Well, that's good to the aircraft.
Yes. Because I've heard various explanations there, and yes. It's established now, although the Japanese Navy at one time had a couple of them on the foot.
Yeah, they found the pup power gun upset about it being on the port side because apparently the air was not called disturbed.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
It had to do with the talk of the propellers on current aircraft, yeah? They
threw
them in a certain direction.
Yes, well, that's a different reason, isn't it? There's no different reason for this one. I've still got to learn it.
John, what was the idea of the two heavy funnels and the two thin funnels?
That's what I say. Instead of having 6 funnels,
yeah,
which would have been all right, or 3 big funnels, they only have 3 more of them. Instead of having 6 funnels or 3 big ones, for some reason or other, they have these funnels, by the way, are double the capacity of these. So you could say you've got the capacity there of 6 funnels, 2 to each boiler.
John, regarding your anti-aircraft gun,
I noticed in Vassil's report on his famous fight for these Zeppelins. He said the Zeppelin ran out of bombs and he'd fired 60 rounds and he'd run out of ammunition. And was that the only stowage they carried for anti-aircraft ammunition, 60 rounds?
Oh no, they would have carried more than that, surely. That might have been all his ready-use ammunition. Probably his ready-use, that's all, and they couldn't get up from underneath. But I would have thought they would have had more than that. This was after the Sydney had her gun installed, of course. She was attacked by a Zeppelin before she had the gun installed. I don't know whether you knew that.
He said there he fired 60 rounds and he ran out of ammunition. He was thankful that the Zeppelin had run out of bombs at the same time.
Yes, well, it could have been, but in those days anything could have happened. 60 rounds seems not very much to me. I would have thought it was 160.
How many rounds began to be carried at 60?
I couldn't tell you that. No, I couldn't tell you the number of rounds. I know there were lots of them when you had to load them. Load them into the magazine. We'll have a few slides. Any further help? Any other questions on the diagram before we put it away? Arrived in Sydney Harbour on the 4th of October 1913. They came in this order. The Australia was the flagship, of course, the Telefreak Australia, and followed by the Melbourne and Sydney. Melbourne was the senior ship of the cruisers. Her captain was Captain Silver, and Captain Glossop was Sydney's captain. They were followed, of course, by the old encounter. And the destroyer flotilla, which at that stage considered the Warrego, Crown Mather, and Yarra. Can everyone see the slides? Elevator. Yes, you can have a better. That's good. I'll just hand my cigarette back and have a drink. Next slide, then. This is a photograph of the fleet as they anchored that day on the 4th of October 1913. Over to the left here would be the Opera House, present Opera House site. About two cables to the east was the flagship Australia, and spaced equally between her and Garden Island, which you see over here, were the Melbourne and Sydney. Over in neutral bay, in a less conspicuous position, the old encounter lay. The destroyers found a haven in Inner Farm Cove, and the Cambrian, the last British flagship, was also an Inner Farm Cove. And this is a historic picture because when the ships tied up, just before they tied up, the Australia fired a salute to the British flagship and the salute was returned. They all moored to their respective buoys. This number one was the traditional flagship buoy, had been well over half a century since the formation of the Australia squadron in 1859. Australia tied up. The signal was given to dress overall, they dressed ship overall, and the ferries tooted, and the people cheered, and it was a great occasion. I was amongst this crowd somewhere sitting on my father's shoulder at the time. Next slide, please. We talked about the 6-inch gun. This was a picture I did many years ago with Sydney Mail. It was published in the Sydney Mail that commemorated the 25th anniversary of the Sydney sinking in Emba. So I just extracted this from that particular picture. Not very good as an artist for human figures, but it does show the gun's crew and how they were stationed at the gun. The little 6-inch, the 6-inch gun was very well protected with a cast gun shell, which I think was about 3/4 inch thick. It gave fairly good protection for the people inside against splinters and so forth.
The numbers on the gun layout was here. He's got here on the elevator of the gun and depressed the gun. He was the one that put the thing up and down. He was number one. Number three was the most important person too. He was the bridge loader. The bridge worker at least. He opened and closed the bridge, and when the bridge was open, he had to ream out the lock and insert the tube. You see the tubes round the belt, round his waist. He had to close the bridge to see it was firmly closed after the gun was loaded, and make the interceptor, which signaled to the director tower and the control top that the gun was ready to fire. Because everyone understands fairly well clear of the bridge, because they came back about 18 inches where the gun was firing. You have to be standing there, you have to spend the rest of your days in hospital. They didn't have much of an elevation. I don't know what it was exactly. I think about 30 degrees. Do you know that one, Harry?
The mark
is 11, isn't it? Legal mark is 30, only about 30 degrees. It wasn't a very big elevation. Now, another important person was a little flight-filler here, always a boy, or a very young officer. He had to work both hands at once, work a range of deflection dials, which altered, as I explained before, the angle of the telescope, and the gun layer to get his telescope on the target. The more the range came up, the more you had to lift the gun up and put greater range on the gun. This man here was a trainer, number three. All he had to do was to keep the gun trained on the target, from right to left. We always have a voice part number in case the telecommunications headphones broke down. The voice part number was connected direct by physical voice part, which was only a hose, to the transmission station down below. This man here, his duty was, when the breach was opened, to chill it with the water on this combined sponge and round, called a bazaba, and called by the crew a woolly-headed so-and-so. But that was the idea, to chill the breach, and when the shell, this chappy took the 100-pound shell ready to throw it in as best he can into the breach. Then this chappy and the rammer number would ram the thing home so that the driving band bit into the lightning of the gun. Here we have a chap with a charge, the cordite charge, kept up to the right to the last moment in a fiber container. This little door was, little lid was legged out of the fiber container, and the charge was pushed in by hand behind the gun. And the bridge was closed, the tube having been put in while it was open. Everyone stood clear, the interceptor was made for the gun as well as the fire. That was it. There were several of these loaded numbers, others lined up with shells, having got them from the hoist, ready for their turn. The rate of fire for these guns were officially given in manual was 10 rounds per minute. Well, this is unbelievable. I would never have believed this, I couldn't believe it. I would say a very well-trained crew would make it six or even seven rounds away per minute. But after that, that's anybody's business. It could have got people just by three charges, the biggest guys everywhere. Now, I wouldn't agree with 10 rounds per minute. I don't think any of my old shipmates here would agree either. I'd done that. Always, of course, there was a hose kept handy in case a cordite fire broke out, and inevitably the hose by a few weeks. I think that's about all about the gun. Any other queries about the gun while we're on it? The 6-inch gun? Next slide, please. And we'll have a look at each ship now as it comes in your way. Take them in alphabetical order again. This is the launch of the Brisbane at Cockatoo Island on the 30th of September 1915. The first cruiser and the largest warship of that time built in Australia. You can see the nicely shaped bows of this class. You not all can see an underwater view. There's a bilge keel here and part of the bridge. The bridge was partly standing there, but none of the funnels, of course. Next. picture of the Brisbane, taken very early in World War I. You can see what I mean by the power mast, very tall power mast with a white control top on top of the lower mast. Later on, the masts on all three ships, the topgallant mast of all three ships was taken away, and I think it very much improved their appearance. At that stage, Brisbane was commissioned, by the way, with an anti-aircraft gun. They learned the lesson by then, and Brisbane had an anti-aircraft gun. But no tripod mast, no director bearer. She still carried her two range finders, as you saw in the diagram. Searchlights. She already had a 36-inch searchlight installed on this open-looking tower here, which later was closed in. Next, please. Oh, another picture of Brisbane. This was taken after the war. You can see the difference there with the tripod mast. The mast hadn't been lowered. This was taken in 1920 when the hull of the Australian fleet was to be reviewed by the Prince of Wales at Port Phillip. And the cruisers, with the attendant destroyers, were on their way to Melbourne for that review. This is Brisbane, the ship in the distance of Sydney. Just very, very shortly after the war, because the Sydney's aeroplane platform had not been dismantled at the time, here it was here. Britain must have been warm weather at the time, although that was in the in winter time, but I have this thing authentically dated as mid or May 1920, but I noticed the Brisbane here, I just noticed he had a facial awning out. And these ships never went to sea very much with a facial awning, but anyway, the sailors must have complained about the heat. I don't know what they did with it. Next slide. A picture of the Brisbane taken from the lower bridge of the Brisbane on the port side with a Sydney ahead. This was taken in 1925 as the Brisbane was on her way to China. Anchoring cable gear here, you can see the bow anchor port pipe and the sheet anchor port pipe here on the starboard side. Breakwater here on the forecastle gun here with a white deck locker in the foreground. It was a gun there with a flight. I think it was a little bit of rough weather because I can see a few reflections here on the photo. Next, please. A picture of the Brisbane taken toward the end of the career. Nice looking ship, the same as the others. Brisbane could always be distinguished from the sister ship by this little structure on the former. It was built originally as a searchlight platform, but to my knowledge never used as such. That always distinguished Brisbane from the
Wasn't that the something finished the
reasonable England? It was, yes, it was. No, but it remained with us. This picture was taken in the 1920s, well into the
1920s. Well, the thing is that the control top black, and I was under the impression that sort of went out about 1920.
No. She still had a black control top in China. I was in China in 1925, and the control top is black in
yes.
Seabird here, probably griped. She had a little whaler here in this position, not shown on my diagram, this was an extra boat apparently. I think he was in use as a training ship at this period. These are interesting little fittings. They have a range clock at each end of the ship, one in this position, one right after the searchlight platform. This wasn't worked mechanically or electrically, it was worked by hand. And it was marked in thousands of yards of range. And while the ship was closed up at action stations, and the vessels were in line ahead, line astern, I think they call it now, the operator, knowing the range, the other receiver medium, would set the range on the range clock so that if the ship ahead or astern were put out of action regarding their range finders, they could read the range of the target by the ship following or the ship ahead of them. Next, please. this is one of the last pictures taken in Sydney when the Brisbane was going home to England in 1935, taking the ship's company for HMS Sydney number 2. And it was a picture on the upper deck taken from the port lower bridge, showing the ship's company just hoisting up the whaler. The whaler right out there on the port side. And there are enough sailors there to eat a whale, as you can see. I would say the difficulty in that case would be to stop them when the blocks came up these blocks. But that was the general method of getting up boats and little cruisers. Down here, if you put your head in there and have a snoop, you'd probably smell Chief Cook Hoffman's fish cook, because that was a gallery. And our well-known Chief Cook, George Hoffman, would often be heard to say, give them plenty and cut the big ones in half. Coming now to the Melbourne. I didn't bring the early photos of Melbourne, but she was identical with Sydney, and I had some of that. This was taken about 1917, when she was a unit of the 2nd Light Cruiser Squadron of the British Grand Fleet. Take that in. And you can see clearly here the Stumpless Camel on its little platform. These platforms, by the way, were what they called a revolving aeroplane platform. Earlier than this, about 1916, HMS Yard, a very similar type of light cruiser, had a fixed platform fitted in this position to fly off aircraft. And our Admiral Demerick, who was captain of the Sydney at the time, complained that the fixed platform necessitated the ship steaming directly into the wind. So he had his ship fitted up, and the Melbourne was fitted up later, with a revolving platform, which could be turned several points away from the wind. So the ship didn't have to all across right into the wind to release the little plane. An interesting point about it is the top gallant mast on each mast have been low, not completely struck, but in a lower position. I don't know exactly why this was, but I presume that it was to make it a less conspicuous target. In those days, of course, more so than today, with air reconnaissance, the first sight you got of a ship was the top of a mast. And therefore, if you could reduce your masts quite a few feet, in this case 12, 20 feet, that means to say you were a little bit ahead of the enemy sighting. At this period, she had an anti-aircraft gun installed, and our director tower, of course, and tripod mast, and she looks a very fighting type of ship there. Next day. Melbourne was the only one of our three cruisers during World War I to be fully camouflaged. This picture shows it coming in after patrol. It looks like coming into Ross Isle, Scapa Flow, one of those northern Scottish bases, after patrol. Again, the plane can be seen on the aeroplane platform, and type of camouflage then was very similar to what has been used more recently in World War II. The interesting part about this picture is in the background, anyone who knows naval vessels would have perceived one of these steam-driven K-class submarines just behind me, with a build-up mast. Also, in this war, we had our little blimps, the same as they had. Very similar to the ones that they had in World War II, except that these things were used mainly for reconnaissance purposes and not to obstruct the aircraft as they were in World War II. Next one. This is a picture of the Melbourne in the Mediterranean in 1926. The gun crews had closed up for firing practice. And it seems that she's just running out of a smoke screen, which had been laid by a destroyer, and he had to have all guns trained where she thought the target would be before they opened up. This was a very keen competition in the first cruiser squadron of the Mediterranean fleet, and Melbourne did very well at that time with this competition, the efficiency test for guns. And you can see the guns crew close up here, S1 or S2 here, close up ready, about half elevation ready to shoot. The chap on his range finder here, this petty officer here, probably a range taker, assistant range taker, looking actually through the smoke screen, waiting to give the range taker the direction to train his range finder on to get a range to pass to be the faster the gun so they can get the rounds all quickly. In the very foreground here, this is a little bit forward of course, there's a bridge up here, is the little anti-aircraft gun which was not in use during the first. Next one. This photograph shows HMAS Melbourne entering Portsmouth Harbour on the 30th of April 1936. She'd just done service with the Mediterranean fleet, and you can guess that for a coal-burning cruiser of her age to be pitted against the more modern cruisers, the C and D class, and the flagship was HMS Auckland, HMS Aphrodite, at least, the flagship of the first cruiser squadron. And the Melbourne really had to be efficient, and everyone had to be very well trained to keep up with the more modern ships, which we did, and I think very well. The only grouse we had was when we came into Malta Harbour, having been a few days at sea with the battle fleet, a very big battle fleet then, consisting sometimes of 10 battleships and 20 cruisers and up to 50 destroyers, a very large fleet. And sometimes it took ships all day to get into the harbour. And when we come in, the others would connect up the hose at the oil ship, and we'd have to run alongside the collier to get in 1,000 tons of black diamonds, really, for the next operation. And this was very upsetting to us. But we did manage. Now, at this particular point of time, in this ship, there were some personalities who were later to put Australia's Navy into the history book. The gunnery officer at this moment of time was Lieutenant John Collins, later Vice Admiral Sir John Collins, who was later Chief of the Naval Staff, and as we all know, a great gunnery expert. Another one, a familiar name, was Lieutenant Hector Waller. He was the signal officer of the Melbourne at this time. And we now remember Captain Waller as the commander of the scrap iron flotilla during the war in the Mediterranean, and later he gallantly lost his life when the Perth went down in March 1942 as captain of the Perth. Yet another one was Lieutenant Emil Deschamps. He was the ship's signal officer, and he was the ship's torpedo officer at the time. At this moment. And he, of course, lost his life in the Australia on the 21st of October 1944 during the operation when he was camouflaged in Lady Gulf. Another one, and this is an anniversary of his death, was midshipman, can't think of his name, he was the captain of the Yarra.
Rankin.
Bill Rankin. He was midshipman Rankin on the ship on the Melbourne at the time. And today, 35 years to the day, today, on the 4th of March, 1942, Lieutenant Commander Rankin lost his life when HMAS Yarra was sunk by Japanese forces south of Java. Just one more name, which will ring a bell with all of us. We have another very smart and good-looking midshipman on board called Galfrid Gattaher. He was a midshipman on HMAS Melbourne of this period when he went in and out of Melbourne. And it was some 30 years after when the present Melbourne arrived in Melbourne on a delivery voyage to Australia and her commander was Captain Galfrid Gattaher. So, all in all, 3 hours through. I won't waste time with many of the players, but there were other very famous people on the ship, and they all got a lot of really good training with the Mediterranean fleet. Melbourne, of course, was the only one built the Camel there. She didn't have a spectacular career. She did assist in the capture of Samoa in 1914, and single-handedly, she took over the island of Nauru in 1914 for the British Empire. She finished up going to England in 1928, carrying the crew for the new HMS Australia. A very fine ship, so it was a very efficient ship at that time. Thank you. This is the most famous of the trio, I suppose. This picture was taken at a very early stage, as you can see. Pole masts, no anti-aircraft guns, no searchlight power. It was taken, in fact, on the 4th of November 1914. And it was taken just after she'd received the orders from HMS Melbourne, which was seen as ship of the convoy, taking the first load of Anzac from Albany over to the Middle East. And a few minutes before, Spidley had got the message from Melbourne to proceed to Captain Island to investigate the presence there of a strange ship. The convoy, of course, was escorted at that time by the Melbourne, Sydney, and the Japanese cruiser Aibuki. The Aibuki, as soon as she heard that the strange ship had appeared on Cocos, immediately ordered course without any permission to go. But the Melbourne pulled back of the line and Captain Silver ordered Sydney on her way. Here's a point of difference between Melbourne and Sydney at this period. Of course, in Sydney had three white funnel bands in the fingers of Melbourne. But when the funnel bands weren't there, you could tell the Sydney because he didn't have a gap. And you see the instrument, he just hoisted up to the mast. He had no gap to hoist the instrument. But she was there proceeding to destroy the instrument. Next, please. This is the German crew for England, destroyed by the Sydney on that day. The little England, much smaller than the Sydney, armed only with 4.1 guns, put up a great fight. But overwhelming on, won the day. The Sydney was very new, England was a few years old, and the Sydney had a clean bottom. The engine had been at sea for a long time, no doubt that a few of it was bleeding on it. And all in all, Captain von Mueller put up a great fight against the Sydney, but the odds were too great. And he was forced to run his ship ashore with great losses, and his ship pounded to pieces. He ran on ashore on North Kiernan Island. Next, please. Picture taken from the Sydney of the remains of the engine. This is the just after she was run ashore. As you can see, she was a very sorry sight. The fore was down, all funnels down, and something like 154 people killed, several of them wounded, and the remainder of the people. He did the best he could, and he ran his ship up. And incidentally, up to about 10 years ago, you could still see the remains of the engine on North Keeling Island. I don't know whether they're still there. Probably if you landed, you'd find this is against the line of that. Next, please. Just after the engine was dispatched over the island, some of her crew had escaped. They commandeered a collier, and it was thought that they might escape and cause more trouble. And the Sydney went out in search of them and also for him, the collier of US. This shows the ship's company of the Sydney on the forecastle in chase of the collier. looking for the collier. You can see some of the damage there where the pattern of the run of the bridge. Incidentally, during the action, the former land founder was destroyed and the land breaker and the crew of the land founder killed. Very much before a picture of the Sydney in the North Sea in 1917 or early 1918. The little charter plane was started away in this little structure here to protect her from the wind and weather. She's certainly striking some heavy weather there. The mast, where they're going to shorten, the top yellow mast is shortened. And this is taken from one of the war histories, not my photograph, but it was given here from one of the war histories, showing the Zeppelin that she attacked when we were talking about it before. Pretty rough weather there. Eventually. This is a picture of the Sydney toward the end of her career. She was still a flagship. She's wearing the Commodore's flag of the Australian squadron. And she's also doing job duty, I think. This is her final rig. Somebody talked about the small cost in front of her drive. There's the end of Sydney's career. She had a front of drive, as in the picture. Built in front of drive. By the time the mischief took life had been finally up, and she was almost ready to fly off. She only had about another year or 18 months of life before her. Sydney, incidentally, had several firsts and owners. She was the cheapest cruiser ever bought for Australia. She cost £385 in the first place. That's the initial cost. This was increased to £400,000 or $800,000, less than $1 million. Now compare this with the price of our DDG. That cost $40 million each. So, one DDG, 40 Sydney. Which would you prefer? I don't know about having, 160 funnels or we can work out all sorts of fantastic things. But however, that was a price. It makes one think of the way the cost of ships has altered since. Of course, they've gone up skyrocketed even since the DDG was fixed. Next, please. This is one of our member and New Zealand member John Spears pictures of the Sydney, which I thought was very nice. John was good enough to paint this for me many years ago. Shows her in Sydney Harbour. Lying at the flagship buoy, dressed overall, and a very fine sight she made there. Clearly in the picture we can see the range clock on the searchlight platform, and some of the other features, like the black and white bats, which were peculiar to the flagship at the time, and she looked, all in all, very smart, I think you will agree. Next, please. This is a picture which is unusual. It shows Melbourne and Sydney lying alongside each other in Palm Cay. The date is October 1927. Sydney was the flagship of the squadron, and she's just preparing, it was a convenient way then, to transfer the flag, the Commodore's gear and accoutrements, over to another ship by lying alongside each other. Put a couple of rounds across and the job was done very quickly. Sydney's transferring the flag to Melbourne and also transferring a few privileges too. Because prior to this, Sydney was a flagship. People could, the ship's company were allowed at certain periods to smoke below decks and do all sorts of things that you couldn't do on a private ship. It was very good. And these privileges were transferred to Melbourne with a flag. I was unfortunate in joining Sydney a few days after this picture was taken, and I couldn't smoke on the best deck, and the Melbourne people could. Another point of distinction between these two ships, if ever you saw them at this period, when they had a strike off in Sydney after the war, sort of from the Sturdy could tell the Sydney from the Melbourne immediately. The Sydney didn't have a foothold right off, but the Melbourne did. So the captain or the admiral could look right out the stern, but you couldn't get it to do the same on the Sydney. The admiral's quarters, or the commodore's quarters, the captain's quarters when it was made commodore, were very comfortable. They kept, they took up most of this part of the ship. I never lived there, but I've worked there on the captain's staff sometimes, or some reason, electrical equipment when it was working there. Well, I think that's about all the slides now. I don't get any more there. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's about all I can tell you, unless there's any other thing, little thing you want to know about the cruiser. I'll be very anxious to, very happy to try to answer any further questions.
John, would you explain that range finder on the back? Why was it on the back?
This range finder on the back?
Yes.
So it wasn't on the back. It was in this position, as you can see in the dark.
Yeah.
There it is there, see?
Mm-hmm.
That was a duplicate of this one. So that if the former range finder went out of action, there it is there. The little after control for that one, you had another range finder. There's one on each ship.
Why was it so bigger?
Why was what that? The range finder?
The range finder, no, the clock.
Oh, the clock. Oh, this one here?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I suppose they put the... That was the standard size, about the standard size. They put an admiral in captain and they made it this size.
What sort of condition were the ships in by the time they paid off, John? Were they starting to fall up?
No, they were in very good condition. They were always very well maintained. And the Sydney, I paid the Sydney off in 1928, and this was a camera, and she was in very good condition at the time. But the ships were maintained in very good condition. There were plenty of ships coming to do it. And there was no rust, they were in very good condition. And the brass work on the guns was clean every morning. We must have used gallons and gallons of brass there every year. It was astounding.
To get the brass out.
What about
it? We used to be ducks.
Oh, this was brass there. I don't know what ducks, this was brass there. I think we used to buy it for $5,000.
The tonnage of 5,400, is that the displacement?
The displacement tonnage.
And how did that compare with the Encounter tonnage?
The Encounter was about 5,800. She was a much fatter ship and a much shorter ship, but she was slightly heavier in displacement.
Yeah, I was always under the impression she was about 3,700.
5,800 was her normal displacement. We didn't have standard displacement like they have these days. There was no law laid down. This was a normal displacement, 5,400.
And the Encounter was shorter, but greater length.
Greater length. Thank you.
John, why no smoking below decks on a private ship? Or rather the reverse, why allow smoking below decks on a private ship?
Well, it was just the admirals of the Commodore perks, the Commodore's privilege, to let things happen on his ship, which didn't happen on other ships.
Is that a general rule, or isn't that
particular? No, it wasn't a general rule. No, not general for everything. In my day, smoking was never allowed below deck.
Secondly, John, he may have had very comfortable digs down up, but since he was where he was, he would have had a very noisy set of quarters.
Yes, admittedly, you may have experienced. I don't know why the officers lived down that either, because I prefer the other.
Well, they tried to come by the 1906 with the general. Because the usual drill, of course, was crew forward, officers up. They reversed us in Dreadnought in 06. And nobody liked it. And so they reversed us, sent us back.
It was the same on the Australia. The crew was after the Australia in that picture you saw tonight. The crew were after it. That was in the building of Dreadnought.
Yeah. Well, that was Fisher's idea.
The Admiral's Sternwarp was always a feature of British warship
development. We didn't have one here. We didn't have one. Not on our ship.
Well, thank you, John. Very interesting address. Not the first time I've heard you, and as in other times, you really captured your audience, captured me anyway. And I did like to And it gave me a little bit of information which did come out of the process. And even when you dropped your notes.
I don't know. That's the first job, I did say that, and Lou's sitting a wonderful speaker, and of course he's confirmed that tonight, there's no doubt about that. I don't think we'd find another expert on the old four stacker. I can well remember the four stacker too, John, believe it or not. I'm not that old, but I can still remember them in Sydney Harbour there, and as you can see, John's own drawings and these early archive photographs, and just to clarify one situation, why the aeroplane took off to such a short distance, the Sopwith Pup, they'd rev it up until they had it revving at about 60 miles an hour, and they used to hold it on the wheels by manpower, and then hold it on the wing by manpower, and then when the pilot dropped his hand, all of them just let it go, and of course the plane had just sort of rise straight up in the air. Nine times out of ten it did, I might add. Anyhow, ladies and gentlemen, on your behalf, once again, thank you very much, John, for a very wonderful lecture.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.